Hi, I'm David Kleon. I'm senior editor at Longheads TV. This is an episode of Worldwise, and I'm recording this from New York City. And I'm speaking here. It's 11:30 p.m. on Thursday night here in New York City. And meanwhile, it is 9 in the morning in where you are. So why don't you tell us where that is and who you are?
Okay. My name is Samant Subramanian. I'm a journalist, and I live in Delhi, where it is upwards of 110 degrees at 9 in the morning. I work for a paper called The National, which is based in the UAE, and I do a bunch of freelancing otherwise, and a lot of my work over the recent few months has been concerned with the Indian election, which just ended a few weeks ago.
Right, and I saw you had a piece about it in the New Yorker, which we'll link to. So the Indian election, I just want to say two things about that up front before we launch in, for the benefit of our audience. One is that, of course, we would have ideally liked to cover this a few weeks ago when it was a huge story and there were various scheduling issues and it got pushed back. But I think India is obviously a hugely important country. This was a really important political story in India. And we think it's still relevant. So we're glad that we're able to do this now. So that's one thing. The other thing I want to say is that, although I hope I'm decently well informed about it, I've never been to India. I'm not an India expert. I approach this as an American amateur who reads newspapers, or their online versions. So with that out of the way, let's talk about the Indian election.
Okay.
So before we get into the result of the Indian election and what it all means, if you could just take us back a couple of weeks ago and maybe capture in anecdotes you saw personally, or just kind of give us a sense of what an Indian election is like. I know this one and probably every previous Indian election was the largest election in human history or something like that. Tell us what that actually entails and what the largest election in human history looks like.
Well, I mean, I should mention that this is the third Indian election that I'm covering. I covered the elections in 2004 and then in 2009 with progressive sort of degrees of engagement. This was probably the most hectic one. As you said rightly, each Indian election is largest in human history. It doesn't always, we don't have a single polling day. We don't have sort of one day where 600 million people go out and cast their vote, 800 million people. You know, it's staggered over sort of a number of weeks. This is partly because the country is huge. There's a large number of people, partly for security reasons. And so it feels like this huge staggered process. This one lasted upwards of 5 weeks, which meant it was the longest that India has ever sort of stretched its election out. And to many people, it actually felt way too long. I should also mention that of the three elections that I've covered, this is the one that was, I guess, talked about and discussed the most. I mean, Indians love to talk about politics in any case. But I've never seen sort of the kind of anecdote that I related in my New Yorker piece, which is basically sort of people at a regular dinner party just sitting down and actually kind of counting the number of seats that each party is likely to win, almost as if they were election analysts on TV.
Right.
This has never happened before. I mean, you'd go state by state and almost like sort of constituency by constituency, candidate by candidate. And so this particular election really felt like it's almost suffocatingly all around you at all times. And this was, as I said, this was well, maybe a year in advance of when the country actually went to start voting. So it's been it feels like a year-long election rather than a five-week-long election.
Wow. Now, did you get, you're in Delhi right now, but did you get around the country? I mean, how was it in different parts of the country?
I did, and admittedly, you're right. I mean, Delhi, you know, bathe in these political waters 24/7, pretty much all
right.
year round.
I grew up in Washington D.C., so I kind of know how that is. I was raised around people who actually do think about what seats is each party going to control, year after year. So I can relate. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, but this, on this particular occasion, this seemed to be happening around the country. I went to Bombay, I went to Hyderabad, I went to Gujarat, which is the home state of the now prime minister. And this was all sort of in during the electioneering process in the 2 months before the votes were cast, and then when the votes started being cast as well. And this was, you know, I mean, as I said, although the feeling was more intense in Delhi, you could see this everywhere. I mean, there was a certain sort of animating political spirit that pervaded conversations in every one of these cities and regions that I went to.
Wow. So American elections are sort of known for having not very impressive turnout. I mean, even in a high turnout presidential election, that might be in the 50s. And we've had, you know, this whole, maybe, I don't know if they're following this in India, but this whole controversy about voter ID laws and sort of debates about how much access poor people in the U.S. have to the process, you know, and the election's all on Tuesday and, you know, can people make it out? So how sweeping socially, how inclusive and participatory is Indian democracy, especially in a country with such a large, very poor population?
Well, the answer is surprisingly inclusive. I mean, in every election, there's always going to be some reports of sort of people who have their names left out of the voter roll call list. There's never 100% turnout. And so on this particular occasion, I think there were around 800 million people who were eligible to vote. I think around, I remember the figures being around 550 million votes cast. So, you know, so that's clearly sort of, I don't know what you call, maybe 80%, 75-80% turnout. But as you said, in a country with, a you know, 1.2 billion people in so many constituencies, such a density of population, it's amazing how good a job the Election Commission does. The Election Commission is the sort of agency, the independent agency that is charged with carrying out these elections, and they are the ones who sort of set up polling booths in all these constituencies, making sure that, for example, you don't have to go more than 2 kilometers away from your house to cast your vote. There's been stories of polling booths set up in the Himalayas. There's been stories of polling booths set up in a place where there's really just one voter in the middle of a forest somewhere, I believe in Gujarat, where the booth was set up exclusively for him, because there's nobody else who lives within a 2 kilometer radius.
Wow.
And so, you know, huge security arrangements to make sure that the votes aren't rigged, the booths aren't sort of taken over by political workers from either party. It's an amazing process. And there's a new book out by somebody who used to be the chief election commissioner that talks about sort of the background of holding an election, the logistics that goes into it, that I recommend very highly for a lot of your watchers.
We'll provide a link to that. Sorry, what was the name of that again? Just for the name of the book again?
I can't remember the name of the book. The author is a guy called S.Y. Qureshi.
Right, well, we'll find it.
Find it online.
Before we get more into the specifics, it's just such an amazing thing. I mean, plenty of countries that decolonized after, you know, the Second World War, that, you know, have huge wealth inequality and that are much, much smaller and less and more homogenous than India, have had real problems building, a really functioning democracy. To what do you attribute India's relative success in this regard? Why is India's democracy so? Maybe that's unanswerable. But what do you think it is?
That's a tough one. That's like a book length answer.
Well, what's your gut tell you?
What's my gut tell me? My gut tells me that, as in the case of America, for example, I think that there was sort of a very clear vision of what this country should be. I think there were a group of, as you call them, and as we should probably also call them, founding fathers, who sat down at the beginning and envisioned the kind of democracy that India should be. There was a constitution, there was a watertight constitution that was drawn up, again, in a very participatory and inclusive process. This was not sort of, you know, three or four policy wonks sitting away in a room and drafting a constitution. There were sort of constitutional debates. The whole process of drafting this constitution took, I think, upwards of a year, maybe more. And the document that emerged at the end of it really provided sort of the blueprint for the kind of republic and the sort of the institutions of democracy that India enjoys today. So, for example, the Election Commission that I was talking about, this body that conducts the elections, its powers were laid out very clearly. It was made sort of independent of the government that was incumbent at the time. It has sort of the powers to make its own security arrangements. So this is one example of the sort of processes and institutions that go into making India a flourishing democracy. The other question that you might well ask is that, unlike with other South Asian countries, why, for example, the army never came to power, why there was no sort of big army coup as we have seen time and again in Pakistan. Again, this is something that deserves a book-length answer. There's sort of no one easy way to answer this. It's also true to a certain extent that the British system of bureaucracy that was left behind, that India inherited in a sense, was also sort of, you know, it was fairly structured, it was fairly systemic. There were flaws in it, and there are flaws in it that continue to be held over from the British times. But it provided the sort of structure around which a parliamentary democracy could wrap itself. And I think that was, again, that was crucial in sort of ensuring the continuity of India as a democracy.
And I guess one last question about the electoral process itself. How do, especially in such a huge country, and especially with so many poor and I gather illiterate people, how do candidates get their messages out? How is the public informed by and large, beyond obviously urban middle class elites who, you know, I'm sure are the same as urban middle class elites everywhere, but
I mean, there's a surprising amount of overlap now in particular. I mean, in this particular election, for example, the kind of things that we would have assumed would only appeal to the urban middle class media, for example, Facebook. This is something that we would have maybe until the 2009 election thought would have been a, you know, sort of an urban phenomenon. You could appeal to your urban voters using Facebook or using a Facebook page, but this was not a rural phenomenon at all. That has changed. There's a number of people out there, you know, in India's villages and smaller towns who use Facebook, who are on Facebook. The traditional modes of communication, which is basically television, radio, and newspaper, continue to play a very huge role. But there's this circus of electioneering, basically taking out rallies on the roads, making sure that you hold sort of these big election rallies in villages to which hundreds of thousands of people flock from districts around that particular site. This is a very old school kind of electioneering. I mean, it's not even the sort of town hall meetings that you see in American democracy very often. This is just quite literally sort of guys on a stage hectoring the public, right?
The candidates.
Sorry.
I mean, I've certainly been at, you know, big rallies and seen Barack Obama say giving a speech in 2008. I remember those.
Distinction here is, it's interesting. You know, for example, if you take a particular constituency, who are you voting for? You're voting for a candidate from your constituency to enter the parliament, right? Unlike in the U.S., you're not voting for the president himself or the prime minister himself.
Right.
You're voting for your member of parliament, so to speak. So these guys hold rallies in their constituency throughout the electioneering season. But then there's also the prime ministerial sort of, I guess, the face of the party or the candidate of the party. So in this particular case, the BJP projected, you know, Modi as its prime ministerial candidate. And so Modi went around the country sort of holding rallies in constituencies where he wasn't even technically eligible for election, if you see what I'm saying. You know, I mean, he would address sort of 3 to 4 to 5 rallies a day in different parts of the country, trying to boost the local candidates' chances, but also at the same time making sure that there was sort of a unifying message to the entire party's campaign across the country. And this is really one of the few, maybe the first time, that a prime ministerial candidate has taken on the kind of presidential image that you see in American politics, where he has kind of been, for example, said, yes, I'm voting for my member of parliament, but the vote is indirectly a vote for Narendra Modi,
right?
Because he's the guy who has been sort of the face of the BJP's campaign. He's the one who has promised sort of who has made all these promises on behalf of his party. And so the vote ultimately is for him. And I think this is the first time you're seeing this in Indian elections.
So this is a real nationalization of the process, which that's fascinating. Well, so okay, so let's get to Narendra Modi now. And I guess maybe we can also briefly discuss the leader of the Congress Party, Rahul Gandhi, who lost. Tell us actually first about Rahul Gandhi. And Gandhi, obviously a familiar name, although I guess in this case it's not so directly referring to the Gandhi that everybody in the world knows, the Mahatma Gandhi. But what is the Gandhi family? What's its significance? And what is the Congress Party? And how do we get to Rahul?
Okay, well, the Congress is India's oldest party. It's more than 120 years old. It was the party around which the independence struggle was organized in the first half of the 20th century. I mean, the leaders who came out of the Congress Party were the ones who led the freedom struggle throughout the early 1900s. And when India became independent, the Congress was sort of the dominant political party. There were others, but the Congress was the dominant political party in India. And so it was almost by default sort of voted to power again and again in elections throughout the first sort of half of India's independent life. The first Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, was sort of the pillar of the Congress Party. His daughter, Indira, became Prime Minister. Her son, Rajiv, became Prime Minister. Rajiv's son is Rahul Gandhi. He's like Nehru's great-grandson now, I guess.
How did the Gandhi, is that, did they like adopt the name because of Mohandas?
No,
it's a coincidence, or what's the...
No, it is a coincidence. I mean, Indira married Firoz Gandhi. No relation to Mahatma Gandhi, and it just so happened that the name, the patronymic name, sort of came into this family as well. But there's no relation. There's no connection.
Okay, and it doesn't. Is it? I mean, is Gandhi just a common name in India, or is it like?
It's not very common, but I mean, it's not uncommon. I mean, it's common in a particular part of India, in Western India, in Gujarat and Maharashtra. You know, so for example, Mahatma Gandhi was from Gujarat, also the state that Modi is from.
Right.
And, and obviously the popularity of the name in terms of just how widely recognized it was, went up after Mahatma Gandhi's sort of rise to fame. And then subsequently because of the Nehru Gandhi family as well, but it's a complete coincidence. There's no sort of familial relation.
Okay, so notwithstanding everything that we've been saying about India, you know, emerging independent as a functional democracy and mostly keeping that up all these years, in practice, and I know this isn't unheard of in other democracies, it has been mostly dominated by this one party, the Congress Party, and this one family, the Gandhis. So
yes.
And not anymore. So what explains, I mean, obviously they were there from the beginning with independence, with Nehru, but what explains their dominance and what explains their sudden downfall, I guess?
Okay, well, for literally almost like the first 40 years of 35 years maybe of Indian independence, there were no other strong parties to take the Congress on. I mean, it was that simple. I mean, the communists were around. There were parties such as the Hindu Mahasabha, which is sort of the precursor to the BJP that we see today. So there were sort of, you know, little parties that were formed. But these were all, in a sense, stunted parties. The Congress was so dominant, it absorbed, it was sort of the classic big tent at the time, you know, to use a phrase from American politics. It welcomed everybody. So you could be a Muslim and you could be in the Congress, and you could be a Hindu and you could be in the Congress, and you could be a socialist or you could be sort of what was probably then the equivalent of a free enterprise guy, you know, back in the 1940s, and you could be in the Congress. Because the Congress was so vital to the freedom struggle, and because it was vital in the freedom struggle that everybody come under one roof, everybody unify under one roof to power this freedom struggle forward, the Congress welcomed everybody. It was, you know, it was a house for everybody. And so when India became independent in 1947, that dominance continued. And it continued until sort of the mid-70s, when finally, you know, what it took to break the Congress's streak of governance in a way was a complete sort of misjudgment by Indira Gandhi, which is that in 1975, she declared emergency. She suspended sort of a lot of democratic rights, and this went on for 2 years. And it took that kind of lapse of judgment on the part of the Congress for the Congress to finally be voted out. In 1977, when the elections were held, the Congress was voted out. A coalition of other parties came to power, and this was the first time that there was no Congress government at the center. Within the Congress itself, the party has often functioned like sort of a cult of personality, I guess you could call it. Political parties within India, Indian political parties are frequently not democratic within themselves. So, for example, there's no, unlike the primaries, for example, in the US, there is no sort of process of electing within the party a leader or a prime ministerial candidate. And so because of the fact that this cult of personality continued, Nehru was a titanic figure. When Indira started to sort of rise up the ranks of the Congress, she was able to harness her father's name and rise to prominence herself. When she died assassinated, you know, there was sort of a huge wave of sympathy for the Congress and for the family. And so her son, Rajiv, was then able to take over the party. He was assassinated at some point. And so when Sonia Gandhi, his wife, came back to the Congress after sort of a period outside the party in the late 90s, she was able to sort of, you know, ride on her husband's and her mother-in-law's name. And so this is how the party has traditionally worked. They have encouraged sort of a culture of, you know, sycophancy to grow around them. I mean, there's very few people within the party who disagree, who will disagree with a member of the Nehru-Gandhi family, because that would mean, you know, sort of a certain ostracization from the higher echelons of power within the party. And so this has been, you know, it's curious. I mean, in a sense, this has been both its strength and its weakness. And it's perceived now as a weakness, but for a long time it was a strength. I mean, these huge personalities, these members of a family that really sort of defined the first half of independent India's life, you know, these were the people that, India voted for. I mean, they believed wholeheartedly in, for example, Nehru. There was a huge cult of personality built around Indira Gandhi as well. But as a result of which, the party started to suffer sort of its own systemic problems. It just didn't, it refused to address the problems that this, you know, was bringing with it.
I see. So I guess the BJP party, and I'll leave it to you to explain what that stands for, but the BJP party has been rising for a number of years as the main opposition party, and in this election that just concluded, it not only won, which I think was widely predicted, but it won pretty crushingly. I mean, it won a real, I guess we'd say a real mandate.
Yes.
And in most parts of the country, I saw some map, it had a very wide regional dominance. In the southern states, it looked like there were some other parties that might represent regional interests that did okay. Maybe we'll get to that. But it looked like there were only pockets of Congress Party support sort of scattered all over the place. So I guess tell us about the BJP and what it stands for, what they stand for, and sort of if you can trace their rise against the Congress Party.
Okay, the BJP stands for the, if you expand the initials, it stands for the Bharatiya Janata Party, which translates, I mean, literally and quite sort of tamely into just the party of the Indian people. There's no sort of particular, it doesn't sort of signal very effectively what the party stands for. The party was born in the early 1980s. There were precursors to the BJP. You know, there was something called the Jan Sangh in the late 70s and the mid 70s and early 70s. And the BJP was born in the 80s, and it espoused sort of it was a party for India's Hindus. It felt that there had been too many concessions made towards India's minorities, notably by the Congress, which has sort of always championed itself as a party that supported the minorities of the country. And the BJP was propped up, or I guess, it was framed by these other non-political organizations. I mean, they're not political parties, but they're sort of big Hindu organizations that can very well be called right-wing. They envision sort of their idea of India is a Hindu India. It's not sort of a secular India at all. And so the BJP was born out of these ideologies, and it first came to power in the 90s, actually. There has been a BJP government before under Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee that lasted its full 5 years, and that ended in 2004. So this is not the first time that the BJP is coming to power and forming the government.
This is a good example of the aforementioned ignorance on my part, but thank you for pointing that out. But yeah,
that's no, I mean, it's... between 2004 and 2014, the Congress won sort of two terms of 5 years each. Not by itself, I should mention. Both these governments have been coalition governments, in which the Congress is the biggest party and so therefore guides the government, but it needs the support in Parliament of other smaller parties to push it above the majority that is required, which is 272. On this particular occasion, in this election, due to a perception of the fact that the Congress has been corrupt and inefficient and misguided in its governance over the last 5 years, that economic growth has slowed, that its efficiency as a government is poor, the growth of infrastructure has been negligible. Due to these various factors, it was widely perceived that the Congress would lose. Even within the Congress, if you talk to people off the record, they would admit that they were in for a thrashing. But just the as you pointed out, the margin of the BJP's victory, I mean, everybody expected that the BJP would sort of get enough seats so that with the support of a few other coalition partners, it would get its majority in parliament, it would form the government. What very few people expected, and I believe even within the Congress, even within the BJP, nobody expected this, is that the BJP would get the requisite number of seats on its own. So it got sort of, I believe it was 280 or 281, I can't recall the figure exactly now, but well above the 272 mark that is needed to form the majority in parliament, which means right now that it is in a government that doesn't require the support of other coalition partners. There is a coalition there, but the BJP could very well tomorrow just sort of decide to be its own animal and jettison all these other smaller parties to be its own government.
And I guess the danger of doing that is then you're 100% on the hook for everything that happens, right? Might be better to have smaller parties you can scapegoat or something like that.
This is true. But in actions and resolutions, parliamentary sort of motions that require 50% majority, you basically pass these bills yourself, right? I mean, that's the advantage. I mean, you can just sort of push this through. Whereas with the previous two governments under the Congress, I mean, they had to kind of make sure that they had their allies' support on every single bill. Sometimes a particular coalition ally would decide that the bill wasn't to its liking, and so it could potentially withdraw, and then they had to be placated, and concessions had to be made. The BJP is in a position now where it doesn't have to do any of that.
Wow. So I guess, before we get into the big kind of elephant in the room story about Modi, tell us about Modi, the candidate, and what about Modi broadly appeals to people, and why he was able, as we said earlier, to nationalize this race and to kind of run up BJP's margin of victory. Paint us a picture of Modi.
Okay. Well, without going into too much into sort of, Modi's controversial past, which I assume we'll get to at some point.
We will get to that.
Modi has been the chief minister of Gujarat, his home state, since 2001. That's a long time for somebody to be the chief minister of a particular state, 13 years. He's won re-election a number of times. And under his watch, let me put this very carefully. Under his watch, he has held up Gujarat as a model of sort of efficient governance, of economic progress, of sort of industrial success. At a time over the last 2 or 3 years or 4 years when the economy in India was seen to be slowing, it has slowed. I mean, economic growth has slowed over the last few years. Not entirely because of the Congress government's fault. I mean, the worldwide recession had something to do with it as well. But at a time when economic growth in India was seen to be slowing, at a time when the Indian government was seen to be inefficient and unsure of what kind of policy objectives it should pursue from an economic standpoint. This was the appeal that Modi brought. The fact that he would sort of break this paralysis in governance, this paralysis in policy, and push and restart the engine of I had sort of experienced in the early 2000s and the late 90s when the economy was booming and things were and you know growth was high. This was the promise that Modi brought, and he would kind of travel around the country, tom-tomming this message, talking about how employment would rise under him. You know, industrial manufacturing and industrial sectors would boom. All this regulation and bureaucratic sort of red tape that often ties up a lot of economic projects in India at the federal government level would be sort of eased and loosened the way he had done in Gujarat, because he expedited a lot of projects personally, making sure that he vetted them and pushed them through, cutting through red tape that otherwise exists. Mm-hmm. So this was his message.
So this was his message. So I guess maybe we should dive into the controversy, actually, before we go any further. So the controversy, go. What was it? And how responsible was he really?
Oh.
And are you comfortable saying these things on camera? It's a democracy.
It's a democracy, that's yeah. True. So Modi became Chief Minister of Gujarat in 2001. In early 2002, in a town called Godhra, in Gujarat, there was a train carriage full of people who worked for one of these Hindu right-wing organizations that I talked about earlier. Not a political party, but an ideological ally of the BJP. Mm-hmm. So there was a train carriage full of these workers who were, the carriage was burned, a number of people died. The circumstances under which the carriage was set on fire were unclear until later. I mean, there were sort of theories floating around at the time when the incident happened. There was a group of Muslims that attacked this carriage full of Hindus and set the carriage on fire, burning these people to death.
And that's subsequent. No one actually knows if that's what actually happened, though.
Oh, we know now. I mean, there's been inquiries and investigations into it then. It does seem clear that the carriage was set on fire, as opposed to sort of earlier theories about the fact that it might have been an accident and there might have been an open flame within the carriage itself that somehow spread and, ignited the entire carriage. But what happened over the subsequent days was that a wave of sort of religious riots set off across Gujarat, primarily in Ahmedabad, which is sort of the biggest city. And a number of Muslims were killed by Hindus, by mobs of Hindus, more than 1,000 Muslims, definitely some people say as high as 2,000.
Right. I guess it's important in India that when it's a number of people, it really is a horrifyingly large number of people.
Yes, that's So the circumstances in which these riots happened continue to be hotly debated today. I mean, there's no doubt, for example, that these mobs were Hindu mobs, that they were seeking out Muslims, that in many cases they seemed to know sort of the addresses of particular Muslim families, where Muslims lived, and so on, which sort of raises the question of where they got these, you know, addresses from. They seemed to have sort of sheets of paper on which the addresses were written. It almost seemed like sort of a government database or a database maintained by somebody else, just of Muslims living in Gujarat. Why these mobs weren't stopped earlier? Were the police sort of instructed to hang back and let the violence take its course? Were the police sort of, in some cases, actively encouraged to support the mobs? In specific instances where sort of Muslim families called for help, to the police when they were sort of under siege within their apartment as Hindu mobs were outside? Were the police sort of delaying their response? Was there sort of a lassitude by the government under Modi, or at worst, a complicity by the government under Modi, who belongs to the BJP, which has traditionally been held to be a Hindu nationalist party. Was there a complicity or a lassitude that encouraged these riots? So these are all questions that continue to dog Modi until today.
And his only real line is that he didn't, or someone asked him if he regretted any of this, and he said he regretted his handling of the media or something, right? I mean, he doesn't seem terribly broken up about it. But
I think that was one particular line that sounds really callous when taken out of context. But he has said on other occasions that the events were tragic. He's been very careful about the way that he has reacted to this, to the riots since then. Very often he doesn't take questions on the riots. In the prime ministerial campaign, as he has been sort of forced to give interviews, he has obviously been, he has had to answer on a number of questions about the riots. And he's been very careful about the words that he has used. I mean, he has said that the events were tragic and that they pained him. I don't think he has said that he regrets his government's actions in any way, because that would sort of immediately open up the doors to a number of more questions about what he could have done better and so on, which he refused to answer. There have been a number of people, including within his own party, including at some point a woman who was a member of his cabinet at a much later stage. These are people who have been indicted of leading Hindu mobs. And it's been very clear, as I mentioned, that the mobs were very often constituted from these ideological, brethren of the BJP, the RSS, and the VHP. I won't bother to expand those for you, but sufficient to say that these are sort of some of these hardline right-wing Hindu organizations that I was talking about. So this taint, the taint of, as I said, lassitude or at worst complicity, has dogged Modi since then. I mean, it's been complicated by a lot of other things. It's been complicated by the way that he has functioned in Gujarat as a chief minister, which is sort of in a way that kind of onto himself. I mean, there was a time in which he was controlling, more than a dozen ministries in the government himself. There were questions raised about sort of the way in which the security forces in Gujarat carried out what are called encounter killings. I mean, this is a phrase that's very popular in India, which is basically that the police suspects somebody to be a terrorist or a criminal, kills them in a shootout or sort of guns them down, and then later claims that they were doing it for self-defense because this was an encounter. There was danger that there was going to be a shootout, and so it just happened that the terrorist went down first. So a number of the security force officials under him were sort of hauled up for these encounter killings. There was a man called Amit Shah who served for some time as his junior minister for home affairs, and who is still sort of very closely allied to Modi. In fact, he orchestrated Modi's campaign in the recent election in a number of parts of India. But he was one of these people who was accused of masterminding a number of these encounter killings. It's not just the riots. The riots form the biggest part of the stain on Modi's record, but there are many other questions that were raised about the way in which Modi governs, in which he brooks no opposition, whether it's in the assembly in the legislature or whether it's within his own party. The way in which he these are things that have come out in profiles of him, trusts very few people, plays his cards close to his chest. I mean, many of these things seem to be sort of antithetical to the way in which a parliamentary democracy should work.
Right.
So these were all questions that were raised during his campaign. The other questions that were raised were sort of issues that really dog every political party in India today, which is, for example, the question of crony capitalism, the ways in which big corporations sort of pay politicians and bureaucrats off to get licenses or to have to expedite projects. And so many of these charges were laid against the Congress-led government over the last 5 or 10 years. And they were also, although much more quietly, laid against the Modi government in Gujarat.
Well, so actually, I guess one question to ask about the impact of this whole controversy is, India's roughly what, like 10% Muslim, something like that, higher? like
slightly higher, yeah.
Some, yeah, I mean, 150, 200 million Muslims, somewhere in that range, yeah. Right? And who are mostly mostly in the northern part of the country, where I gather BJP generally did pretty well. But are there Muslims voting for BJP, or is that impossible?
The BJP likes to say that there were Muslims who voted for the BJP in this election. And doubtless, I mean, you know, it's not that it's unheard of. I mean, right. You definitely find sort of cases of Muslims voting for Modi. You know, when I was voting, when I was reporting for these elections in Gujarat, I did meet a number of Muslims who, in Gujarat, mind you, where the riots happened in 2002, who were able to sort of tell me that they had put the riots behind them, that they happened, but after 2002, Modi had delivered sort of a government that was relatively clean and uncorrupt, fairly efficient, and that for sort of issues of day, you know, for the issues of day-to-day life, such as, for example, ensuring an uninterrupted power supply, you know, these were sort of day-to-day tasks at which the Modi government excelled. And so they were willing to 2002 riots because the government had been a good one since then. So I've heard Muslims say this. I don't know whether these Muslims then subsequently went into the polling booth and voted for the BJP. Right. They may not have. But this is definitely, you know, these are definitely things I heard. But overwhelmingly, I would, you know, the numbers say that the Muslims of India did not vote for the BJP.
Well, and do you get a sense, notwithstanding Muslims you've just described who seemed, you know, reconciled to or even positive about Modi, is there a sense that among a large part of the country's Muslims, is there active concern? Is there fear? Are there people who... Are there significant numbers of people who really do hold Modi responsible for these riots?
There are a significant number of people who hold him responsible. I have talked to Muslims in the days since the election. I have talked to Muslims who have admitted that they are apprehensive about the sort of freedoms that Modi may trample upon, particularly with regards to Muslims. But I would hate to overstate the case. I mean, I also feel that there is a certain belief in the fact that India's institutions will not allow this to allow the 2002 riots to happen when Modi is prime minister, and that there is, you know, parliament will function in a certain way. In an odd way, I mean, this is a strange thing to say, but in an odd way, there is almost a dilution of Modi's concentration of power as he moves from chief minister to prime minister. Let me explain this. In India, the police departments in each state are controlled by the state government and not the sort of the federal government. And so because that's the case, a lot of states in India right now are governed by parties that are not the BJP. That is, in some cases, the Congress or in the South, sort of regional parties. None of these governments have a vested interest, obviously, or would like to see the kind of anti-Muslim riots that happened in Gujarat in 2002. And so there is a certain security built into the system in that sense, that even if Modi is the Prime Minister of India, and even if in some sort of bizarre worst-case scenario he wants to engineer these huge anti-Muslim riots, it would not be as easy as, again, in theory, if he were Chief Minister of Gujarat and wanted to do the same thing. So institutionally and structurally speaking, I think there is a certain belief that this won't happen.
So I guess one other thing I think we ought to get to before we wrap up, and related to what we've been talking about in terms of Hindu-Muslim relations and the perception of Modi, is, of course, Pakistan. India's huge and often not very friendly neighbor. Indo-Pakistani relations obviously have been fraught since before the beginning. But what are the early signs so far, a few weeks in, as far as how Zardari and Modi are going to be getting along?
I mean, it's interesting because the BJP, and again, its sort of Hindu allies, have often espoused what they call a hardline stance towards Pakistan. this is despite the fact that the earlier BJP Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, conducted a couple of rounds of fairly successful diplomacy with Pakistan under Pervez Musharraf. Mm-hmm. Notwithstanding that, I mean, you know, they've, for example, this whole question of no negotiation with Pakistan until the terror stops. This is a line that the BJP has often sort of held out and the Hindu allies have held out, which basically means that until sort of what they call cross-border terrorism, that is terrorists who are trained in Pakistan and then sent over onto Indian soil, until this sort of cross-border terrorism ceases, India should not sort of negotiate with Pakistan. This has been sort of a stance that has often been articulated, which made it somewhat of a surprise that when Modi was sworn in as Prime Minister, he invited the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to his swearing-in ceremony.
Did I say Zardari earlier?
I think you may have.
I feel terrible. It's also really late here. Please forgive me. Go on.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. I'll let it stand. So, Sharif, of course.
It wasn't just Nawaz Sharif. I mean, it was leaders of all of the South Asian nations. But the fact that Nawaz Sharif was invited, that he came over to Delhi and participated, or was a witness to, I guess, Modi's swearing in. And then on the subsequent day, I think it was the 17th of May, there was sort of, you know, a round of, breaking the ice diplomatic talks between Modi and Nawaz Sharif. Some analysts in India have seen this as a surprise, as a sign that Modi is perhaps not as obdurate in his foreign policy towards Pakistan as the BJP has claimed India should be in the past.
So do you think there will be implications for U.S.-Indian relations with the new with the BJP in charge, especially given that U.S.-Pakistani relations are always complicated?
There's no doubt that the previous Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, was definitely the kind of leader that the U.S. would have liked to see in India. You know, he was sort of an academic and the classically soft-spoken technocrat. Modi, as you may well know, for a long time was denied a visa to even visit the United States because of the 2002 riots.
Right.
That position has now been reversed, and I believe, in fact, that Barack Obama has extended an invitation to Modi to visit the U.S. in September. So that visit will be sort of Modi's first to the U.S. in decades. I'm unsure. I mean, I think there's a couple of prongs of thought here. On the one hand, if Modi sort of promises the kind of efficient economic governance, the elimination of bureaucratic red tape, to expedite sort of these projects and investment, especially from overseas, there's going to be huge pressure on the United States by American corporations that are willing and eager to come to India and to play a bigger role in Indian markets. There will be pressure on the American government to sort of to maintain friendly relations with Modi, because it is crucial for these countries, like, for example, Walmart, is a fine example. It is crucial for Modi to allow the relaxation of certain investment rules that would allow Walmart to set up shops in India. That's one example. So the pressure on the American government will be huge. I have no idea. Modi has any
sorry, stance. Sorry, can you say that again?
I said Modi hasn't articulated any particular foreign policy ideas towards America in particular as yet. It's going to be interesting to see sort of what his dynamic will be with somebody like Obama or what the dynamic of the new Indian government will be with the American government.
Yeah. Well, I guess before I get to sleep and you start your work day, do you have any final thoughts? But really, like, what's your are you generally optimistic about this turn of events for the country, or what do you think this means for India in a very broad sense, domestically?
Okay, it seems sort of to stand it on its head to declare my affiliations up front now towards the end of the interview. But I should say that I'm not a big fan of Modi, I would. Sort of my best case scenario would have been a coalition government in which the BJP had other parties. The BJP formed the government and had other parties in the coalition, but the other parties were able to pressure Modi to pressure the BJP to put forward sort of a more moderate candidate, somebody who wasn't Modi, as prime minister. This was something I was hoping for, and it didn't happen.
And are there people who you can, like, are there specific people you have in mind who might have been good fits?
Or? Well, you know, there were a number of theories floated, right? For example, I mean, last year there were theories floated that the BJP would get enough seats to be able to form the government, but then not enough seats to have a majority by itself. So they may kind of draft, you know, one of its coalition allies leaders as prime minister, or there may be sort of a more moderate leader within the BJP. Sushma Swaraj, for example, who was the leader of the opposition during the last government, draft these people in as prime minister. This was a theory that was floated. Of course, it all fell apart when the BJP basically won its own majority without the help of any other party. So am I optimistic? I mean, it's very difficult to say right now. I mean, I'm not as direly pessimistic as some of Modi's fiercest critics are. I mean, I don't see sort of an immediate and widespread sort of Hinduization of the country. I think, and I have been told by people who know him well, that he is shrewder than that. Modi is shrewd enough to know that he, having campaigned on this plank of sort of economic governance and progress, he will have to concentrate on that over the next year or year and a half first. Mm-hmm. And that may well be to the benefit of the country. I mean, there's nobody who would argue that we could do with a less corrupt government.
Right.
And
I'll say, by way of concluding, that I recently and before, a few months before this election, finally got around to reading Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Liu, which is I've been meaning to read since it came out a couple years ago. Anyone in the audience who hasn't read that book yet, we'll link it. You don't need to have any knowledge or background or particular interest even really in India. It's just an incredible piece of reporting. And it is set in the most poor, desolate slums near the airport in Mumbai. And it's just kind of a portrait of a real portrait, reported portrait, but it reads like fiction of life in those slums. But it mostly focuses on the people, it also on the individuals that it's covering, it also kind of tells a larger story of an India that has been rapidly globalizing and developing and seeing huge spikes in wealth, but there are still people on the edges of that and on the edges of India's sort of, you know, biggest city, who are in the most dire poverty and who are sort of improvising. So, I mean, it gave me a sense of a country where a lot of people are being left behind. And I guess, I don't know if you want to close with any thoughts on that, on the book and on that idea.
I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, you know, globalization and sort of the liberalization of India's economy over the last two decades has had two effects. I mean, one is definitely that it has lifted, without question, large numbers of people out of poverty, above the poverty line. But the second also is that inequality within India's society has grown, as it has in the United States. I mean, it seems to be sort of a side effect of a neoliberal world order, if you will. That's true, yeah. I would hesitate to link it too closely to sort of Modi's next 5 years in power. I think the problems that are driving this inequality and that are the problems that are causing people like the characters in Kate Pooh's book to be left behind by this huge economic wave are systemically embedded in India in a way that 5 years of government will probably not be able to change it. I mean, it requires sort of decades of, you know, you could almost call it social engineering in a way. I mean, there's problems of caste and there's problems of land and of ownership and the way in which capital is structured in India. I mean, these are huge, huge problems, and these are problems that, however well-intentioned a government may be, it would find it difficult to alleviate, you know, in large measure over the next 5 years.
Well, Sumanth, thank you so much. And I know this went kind of long, but I think this is a really fantastic overview of the elections. And I hope we'll have you on again in the future. This was really terrific. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Glad to talk to you.